Good afternoon, and Tim, thank you very much for that introduction. It's a real pleasure to be in Melbourne again, and particularly to be able to participate in today's Future Summit. As you're no doubt all aware, the Australian economy is currently going through some very major structural adjustments. It's adjusting to a once-in-a-century boom in the terms of trade and business investment, and to a very high exchange rate. It's also adjusting to a return to more traditional patterns of saving and borrowing by the household sector after more than a decade in which consumption and debt grew much faster than people's incomes. Now, these changes are occurring in an economy that has over recent times performed much better than all other advanced economies. The unemployment rate in Australia remains low, outputs continue to expand, inflation's contained, the banking system is sound, and public finances are in a much better shape than in most other developed economies. Yet despite all this, the structural changes that are taking place are creating a sense of unease for many in the community, particularly amongst those who are not benefiting directly from the resources boom. So this morning I would like to touch on three interconnected issues, all of which relate to structural change. The first of these is the recent GDP growth and inflation outcomes in Australia and what they tell us about the evolving balance between supply and demand in the economy. The second issue, and one that the bank's staff have been grappling with for some time now, is the different growth paths of the mining and the non-mining parts of the economy. And a particular question here that we've been looking at is what rate of output growth in the non-mining economy is likely to be consistent with low inflation during this once-in-a-century investment boom that we're now experiencing. And the third issue I'd like to touch on is the Board's recent decisions on monetary policy and the bank's latest forecasts for output and for inflation. So first, to the recent outcomes. A year ago, the Reserve Bank's central forecast was for aggregate output in Australia to increase by around 4.25% over 2011. Our forecast for aggregate demand growth was stronger than this, with some of the very strong growth in aggregate demand being met by even stronger growth in imports. Now, as things turned out, the outcome for aggregate demand was pretty close to what we expected, an above-trend rate of 4.5%. But in contrast, growth in aggregate output was slower than we had expected, at a below-trend 2.25%. When we look at why output growth over 2011 was not as strong as we'd forecast, well over half the difference is accounted for by unexpectedly weak growth in exports, particularly of coal. It's taken longer than was originally expected to remove water from the flooded coal mines and for firms to take advantages in increases in port and rail capacity. As a result of this, despite all the talk about Australia experiencing a resources boom at the moment, the volume of resource exports last year increased by only 1%. Obviously, stronger outcomes than this are expected this year and into the future. But exports are by no means the full story. Other factors were also at work, with more of the strong growth in domestic demand being met through overseas production rather than domestic production than we originally thought. An important factor here has been the composition of the growth in demand in our economy. As I mentioned a moment ago, growth in aggregate demand was pretty close to what we expected, but the composition of that growth contained quite a few surprises. In particular, while the Reserve Bank had long expected a very large lift in investment in the resources sector in 2011, and this increase did indeed occur, it was even larger than we had forecast. And as one indication of the very strong outcome, the ABS estimates that engineering investment last year increased by almost 50%, which is an extraordinary outcome. On the other hand, growth in demand not directly related to the mining investment was not as strong as we had forecast. And the biggest surprise here was probably in terms of home building. We had expected dwelling investment approvals to pick up gradually over 2011, but this pickup has not eventuated. Now, one possible explanation for this is that it is one of the side effects of the return to more traditional saving and borrowing behaviour by households that I mentioned at the outset. This change in behaviour is having significant ripple effects right through the economy, including through a lowering of expected capital gains on housing. In turn, this has made developers, financiers and households less willing to commit to new construction. This is despite rising rental yields, lower prices relative to income, and ongoing growth in the population. While at some point these improving fundamentals should generate a pickup in home building, the recent forward-looking indicators do not suggest that this is imminent. Another area that was weaker than expected was private business investment outside the resources sector. And this partly reflects the decline in business confidence over the year, with reflecting a number of factors, including renewed concerns about the fiscal problems in Europe. Public demand was also weaker than expected. In contrast, consumption growth was in line with our forecast, with total consumption increasing broadly at the same rate as household income. Now, this particular composition of overall demand growth, with its heavy weight on mining-related investment, which tends to be very import-intensive, has contributed to very strong growth in aggregate imports in Australia. Or put a little differently, it's meant that the strong growth in aggregate demand that we've seen has, at least to date, not boosted domestic production in the same way as might have occurred in the past. And as a result of this, there's been less pressure on domestic capacity than we earlier expected. And in turn, one consequence of this is that the inflation pressures that were clearly evident at the beginning of 2011 have moderated. At the beginning of last year, underlying inflation looked to have reached a low point of about 2.25% and was starting to rise and was expected to be close to 3% by the end of 2011. As things turned out, inflation did pick up in the June quarter last year, but it then began to moderate, with the latest reading for underlying inflation over the year to the March quarter being in the lower part of the medium-term inflation range of 2-3%. Not surprisingly, the prices data reflect the particular composition of aggregate demand that we've witnessed. In parts of the resources sector, costs remain under upward pressure, with very strong demand for some intermediate inputs and for a range of occupations, particularly in engineering and sciences, but also in accounting, legal services and human resources. In contrast, in a number of other parts of the economy, the subdued demand growth is putting downward pressure on prices. You can see in the latest CPI there were price declines for most goods, the price of domestic holidays, and the price of new dwellings. These are all areas where demand growth has been soft and firms' margins are under downward pressure. So to summarise, the overall picture is one in which aggregate demand growth has been strong, and it's expected to continue to be so. However, a higher than average share of that growth in demand is being met through imports, not only because of the high exchange rate, but also because of the heavy weight of resource sector investment in overall demand growth. And partly as a result of this, as well as the direct effects of the exchange rate on the prices of imported goods, the recent inflation outcomes have been subdued. I'd now like to turn to the second issue, and that's the size and growth rates of the mining and non-mining parts of the economy. Well, for many decades, the ABS has published separate data on farm and non-farm GDP. It does not publish separate data for mining and non-mining GDP. It does, however, publish gross value added of the mining sector, and this is currently equivalent to a little less than 10% of the output of the economy as a whole. But this figure does not include the very significant imports into the mining sector produced by other industries, and given this, we found it helpful to consider broader measures of the mining-related economy, And the main approach we've used here is to start with the expenditure components of GDP, summing resource exports and investment in the resources sector, and then subtracting the imported component of that investment. To that, we add resource production for domestic consumption, less the imported inputs that go into that production. And this gives us an estimate of total expenditure on resource production and investment that's satisfied by domestic economic activity. And to complement this analysis, we've also used input-output tables published by the ABS, which detail the linkages from demand for mining output and investment to activity in other sectors of the economy. Not surprisingly, this analysis shows that mining investment draws significantly on construction activity, which in turn generates activity in industries such as business services, manufacturing, transport and wholesale trade. When we put all this together, it suggests that the resource sector accounts for around 16 to 17% of current GDP. Of course, we can make different assumptions and use different approaches, and they deliver higher or lower numbers, but most alternatives deliver estimates in the 15 to 20% range. The approach that we've adopted includes the output of workers who indirectly provide inputs into the mining sector. Defined this way, mining-related employment counts for around 8% of total employment, although only around 2.75% of the workforce is directly employed in mining and resource processing. The rest of this 8% are involved in a wide range of activities related to the mining boom, including construction, utilities, project management, legal services, surveying, leasing, etc. Based on these figures, mining-related activities estimated to have expanded by around 12% over the past year, and we're expecting broadly similar growth over the next couple of years. If this expected growth in mining-related activity occurs, the mining's share of GDP will continue to increase, and there will be very strong jobs growth, both directly in resource extraction and processing, in a wide range of ancillary services. Indeed, it would not be surprising if over the next few years, growth in mining-related employment was as high as one half of the total growth in the Australian workforce. If these broad forecasts for mining-related activity come to be realised, then employment growth in the non-mining part of the economy of around 0.75% to 1% a year is likely to be needed to maintain the unemployment rate around its current level. The rate of output growth in the non-mining economy would then depend upon the rate of productivity growth. And if, for example, productivity growth were to average 1% to 1.25% a year, then the non-mining economy might be expected to grow by around 2% per year on average. This is above the recent rate of growth in the non-mining economy, which we estimate to be a little below 1%, but it is below the long-term average of a bit above 3%. There are, of course, a wide range of other scenarios here, and these calculations are best thought as a guide to the broad configuration of output growth that might be possible given the supply-side constraints in the economy. Inevitably, there are a number of uncertainties. Foremost amongst these are the future rate of productivity growth in the non-mining economy, and importantly, the ability of the labour market to effectively match workers with the new employment opportunities that are being created. And these are both issues that we will be watching very carefully as we continue to assess the balance between supply and demand in the overall economy. The broad conclusion that we reach from this work is that given the huge pipeline of mining investment and the current relatively low unemployment rate, it's likely that conditions will continue to vary significantly across industries for some time to come. This work also serves as a reminder that improving productivity growth remains the key to strong output growth in the non-mining parts of the economy. This work also suggests that there is some scope for non-mining related demand to grow a little more quickly than it has been doing over recent times. I'd now like to draw all this together with a few remarks about monetary policy and the Reserve Bank's latest forecasts. In the first half of 2011, our judgment was that strong growth in demand, together with the evidence that inflation had picked up, required mildly restrictive financial conditions. As the year progressed, though, and it became evident that the strong demand growth was not putting the expected upward pressure on domestic capacity and thus prices, the board eased monetary policy, lowering the cash rate in both November and December. And then following the recent CPI data, which provided confirmation of the subdued inflation pressures, the board lowered the cash rate by a further 50 basis points, bringing the cumulative decline since November to a full percentage point. And over this period, most lending rates in the economy have fallen by around 0.75 percentage point and are now at slightly below average levels. The bank's latest inflation forecast is for underlying inflation, abstracting from the effects of the carbon price, to stay close to its recent rate over the next 1 to 2 years. Given that the disinflationary impact of the appreciation of the exchange rate on prices of imported goods is likely to lessen over time, this forecast incorporates some moderation in domestically generated inflation pressures. In particular, it's based on an expectation that productivity growth will pick up somewhat as firms respond to the difficult trading environment that many of them face. It's also based on an expectation that the current pressures on margins being experienced by many firms in the non-mining parts of the economy will work their way up the production chain, leading to some moderation in growth in input costs, including in the cost of labour. In terms of output, overall GDP growth is expected to return to trend over the forecast horizon, with the recent reductions in the cash rate providing some boost to demand in the non-mining related parts of the economy. However, it does seem likely that growth in some sectors will remain below the average experienced over the past couple of decades. How things develop will depend importantly on the ability of firms to improve their productivity and on the ability of the labour market to match workers with the new jobs that are being created. Finally, as we work our way through these myriad of issues, it is important that we do not lose sight of the considerable benefits to Australia from the lift in the prices of our key exports and the unprecedented levels of investment that are now taking place. I've talked about how these developments are changing the structure of our economy, and I've also talked about the challenge they pose for assessing the balance between demand and supply. Yet for all of this, the high commodity prices and the high investment in the resources sector provide Australia with tremendous opportunities. Opportunities many other countries wish they had. As our society works out how best to take advantage of these opportunities, the job of the Reserve Bank is to ensure that inflation remains low and stable and that the overall economy remains on an even keel. In the medium term, inflation targeting arrangements that have been in place for nearly 2 decades now provide a strong framework in which to do this. So thank you for listening, and I look forward to your questions.
Okay, well, thanks, Dr. Lowe. We've got a bit of time for questions. Because it's the Future Summit, I just wanted to kick it off with a broader question. 10 or 12 years ago, we were sitting here at a Future Summit. Many people would have said, we're not new economy enough. Are we too much focus on extractive industries? Is there too much of an issue with the current account? Is our unemployment too high relative to the United States? And yet we now see a big gains in the terms of trade, where being an old economy wasn't a problem. The current account was sort of the dog that barked but never bit. And when we look at our labour market, we've got a lot lower unemployment rate than, say, the United States and our counterparts, despite, you know, people complaining about our labour market institutions. In your own experience as a policymaker, Do you think there's one or two major issues in your own mind that you've really changed your mind on through experience, or that have greatly surprised you in your time as a policymaker?
Yeah, I think the thing that has surprised us most is the lift in the terms of trade. As you said, a decade ago, people thought Australia was an old economy, and we were wringing our hands about the fact that we didn't have a large industry producing technology. Well, that's no longer the case. We now have a very strong resources sector, and I suspect that that's going to continue for some years to come. The issue that we now face, though, is the structural changes that are occurring within our economy as we adjust to the increase in the size of the resources sector. And at least in my own thinking, there are two really critical issues here. One is to keep the flexibility in the economy, because things at the moment look very promising for the resources sector, but one never knows. One never knows what the future has. And Australia has done very well by keeping the flexibility of its exchange rate, by having flexibility on the fiscal side, by having a flexible monetary policy arrangement. So keeping that flexibility is incredibly important. I think the other thing is, and this really touches on the comments that were made in the previous session about education, I think it's highly likely that we will continue to have quite a high exchange rate for a number of years to come. If that's the case, then large parts of our economy have to undergo adjustment. Parts of the economy that are subject to international competition will contract in relative size, but they need not contract that much. And the key to making manufacturing, I think higher education, parts of tourism competitive is for human capital accumulation. And that allows us to have high value added in a whole range of industries. And you can see that now in parts of the manufacturing sector where they are responding. And the parts they're responding is where human capital is being accumulated. So I would align myself with the comments that were made earlier on in the panel here. The importance of human capital accumulation is incredibly important in an economy that is likely to have to live with a high exchange rate for some years to come.
It's the importance of investment in universities. Fantastic answer, Dr. Lai. Okay, questions now. John Quiggin.
John Quiggin, University of Queensland. Right at the end, you mentioned the success of inflation targeting. And if you look at Australia, it looks really successful. The financial sector is stable. We've managed a Taylor rule type of thing where although we target inflation, we deliver low unemployment and trend growth, all of those things. But globally, the picture doesn't look nearly as good. Not only did it fail to prevent the financial crisis, arguably, as your own work suggested, by taking the central bank's eye off things like asset prices, it contributed to the crisis, and certainly it's consistently failed to deliver trend growth in most of the developed countries where inflation targeting is the norm. So I suppose looking at the prospect that very much in Europe and possibly in the US, at least the target and perhaps the whole regime of inflation targeting is going to come under severe challenge, what's the bank's thinking on whether Australia in those circumstances would continue with this framework or look at what's happening overseas?
Yeah. Thanks, John. That's a very good question, and I'm glad you asked it, because in my own view, the problem isn't with the inflation targeting regime in other countries, it's the way that it's been implemented. I mean, Australia, right since the implementation of our inflation targeting regime nearly 20 years ago, we've had a flexible approach. We've never been of the view that our job is to keep inflation always and everywhere between 2 and 3%. What's important is that over time we anchor the community's expectation about what type of ongoing rate of inflation you could expect in this country, and I think we've done that relatively effectively. The problem in the other countries is I think they took their eye off financial stability considerations. They thought that by just keeping inflation low and stable would generate financial stability. And we've certainly never had that view. You might recall in the early 2000s we talked a lot about the dangers of excesses in the housing market. And we did that within the context of an inflation targeting framework. So I think that the framework is the right one, because it tells the community over long periods of time you're going to have this average rate of inflation. There's a lot of benefits for decision making, for investment, for wage setting of doing that. But just keeping inflation always and everywhere within a narrow band is certainly not good policy, and one needs to look at broader considerations, including financial stability, and be prepared to have the inflation rate move away from the centre for periods of time to address these other issues, but not to allow the average inflation rate to drift. And I think gradually through time we're seeing a people's conceptions about what inflation targeting arrangements can deliver and how they should be operated change. And I think it's right they're changing.
Another question over here.
Hi, Dr. Lowe. My name's Ivan Kay from BSI. Is the reduction of investments in the home building not a result of the lack of liquidity from the banks? And to resolve this, wouldn't a solution be to just slightly turn the taps to provide that funding to the developers to increase the demand, increase the supply for residential property?
I think the main issue is really the change in households' expectations about capital gains. We had a decade and a half where house prices rose very quickly as people prepared to borrow on the back of lower interest rates. Historically, that was a very unusual episode, and it's come to an end, and the households are adjusting to that. And one of the consequences is they're not that interested in borrowing more to push up housing prices, and we see the rate of turnover of housing less than half of what it was a decade ago. And I think the follow-on consequence from that is that developers and individuals are scared to commit to new housing projects and are scared to buy them because they think the price could be lower in a year's time, so they may as well wait. The access to finance to developers is an issue in some parts, but I think the first order issue is really the change in communities' behaviour and expectations. And that's going to take us some time to work through because the fundamentals, I think, for the housing market are still pretty strong. The rental vacancy rate's very low. The rental yield is rising. For quite a few years, the average household size has been rising as more people live in each dwelling. So the fundamentals, I think, are reasonable, but it's going to take some time to work through this adjustment in the household's behaviour.
We can't have a session without the ABC. Neil Woolrich.
Thanks, Tim. Dr. Lowe, thanks for your speech today. It's Neil Woolrich from the ABC here. You touched on Europe in your speech. I just wondered if you could expand on that, please. In terms of the concerns with Europe at the moment and the mounting speculation that Greece might leave the Eurozone, what sort of adverse impact could that have on Australia, both in terms of the near term and over the longer term, in terms of those scenarios that you've outlined in your speech today for the development of the Australian economy?
Yeah, well, there are obviously a lot of different scenarios here, and I don't want to kind of spill them all out. I think the main transmission mechanism would be through a reduction in global confidence and an increase in risk aversion. Because we saw in 2008, when people got very nervous, they can sit on their hands, and that has ripple effects right through the global economy. So that could play out. I don't think it need play out. In Asia, there's still a lot of policy room for policymakers to respond if something bad happened in Europe. I think what we're really seeing there is people, well, as everyone knows, become disillusioned with the fiscal consolidation that's going on. I think 2 years ago, the policymakers there thought they had to institute fiscal consolidation to get the confidence of the marketplace. And for a while, that worked. But now, 2 years later, people are saying, well, this is reducing growth too much, and the focus has turned to growth. In a sense, I haven't found this that surprising because the Europeans used to talk about growth-friendly fiscal consolidation. And I think they were hoping that the fiscal consolidation would lead to an improvement in confidence and the private sector would spontaneously come and spend. Well, that never seemed particularly realistic. And I think the reality of that is now coming home. And so the focus now is doing things on the supply side to improve the growth potential. Since the community is demanding that and the politicians are now responding to that, and it may be that they can do enough with the help of the international community to give confidence to people that the supply side issues can be addressed. I think if that were to take place, the situation could look quite a lot better again quite quickly, but it is a big if. There needs to be significant improvement addressing the supply side. If that doesn't happen, I fear financial markets will again lose confidence in the European fiscal situation.
Thanks a lot. Of course, the upside, Neil, is that there's lots of economics movies now. I saw on the way over Margin Call, and there's a new film coming out called My Big Fat Greek Debt. So there you go. Okay, I think we've got time for two more, Nick. Over here.
Yeah. Hi, my name's Annabelle Crabb. I'm from the ABC.
Oh, hi, Annabelle. Good to see you. Yeah.
I'm afraid.
Yeah. She's doing lunch, everyone, for everyone.
Thank you. 6 days ago, I was in the budget lock-up press conference with the Treasurer, who, under reasonably robust questioning, said at one point, look, we're having a mining boom. We're not having a revenue boom. Now, I think most people would assume that should be the same thing. My question to you is, we all know that it's possible to have a jobless recovery. Is it possible to have a revenueless boom?
you're moving beyond my core area of expertise here. So I can really only repeat what I've heard and read in the budget papers. And I think that the main or a significant issue here is in the capital gains tax, where the decline in asset prices that we've seen over recent years has reduced the flow of capital gains, and that's having a significant impact on the bottom line of the budget. And that will take time to correct, and ultimately higher asset prices will help there. But at the moment, the prospects do not look to be for strong growth in a whole range of asset prices. So that's one factor. I think the change in household spending patterns is another. As I said in my remarks, household consumption growth has been pretty reasonable, in line with household income growth, but there's been services that have been growing strongly, not goods. And there are a whole range of services where there is no GST tax levied. And so the composition of consumption growth has not been helpful for the GST revenue. So they're two factors, but I think you're stretching my area of competence here.
Okay, thanks. I think we have one more question, seasonally adjusted, before lunch. Thank you.
You mentioned the forecasts around revenues, and it's self-evident and very, I think, as we're all very thankful of that. I guess my question turns to risk around those forecasts. Technology keeps marching forward regardless of whether it's disrupting things or not. And, you know, it's certainly disrupting some industry and it's disrupting some economics as well. And I think about the, you know, Billiton have a fairly significant polymer division as well as digging holes in the ground as well, and looking at the amount of polymers being used in structures. Look at the Americans trying to get manufacturing back into America. I was in Washington DC a few weeks ago, and there's a big push to get that back. In your modelling, is that significant, insignificant? I'm trying to understand how robust this reliance is on this idea that the resources as we know it is going to give us the outcomes that you're looking for, and what risk factors there might be in both of those movements.
Yeah, thank you. It's a good question, and one we think about a lot. At the moment, the medium-term horizon for resources, I think, is very positive. We've got still the urbanisation process in China has hundreds of millions of people still to run. And the growth process in India is just really starting, and it's possible that they could go through a not too dissimilar experience to China, although the characteristics are obviously different. So that central scenario, I think, is good for us. The world is hungry for our energy and our iron ore. And I don't see that fundamentally changing, but there is a risk that it could. And that brings me back to these two observations that I made before. The economy needs to retain its flexibility through the exchange rate, through monetary policy, through fiscal policy and the wage system, because we just don't know with certainty what the future is going to deliver. We need to be able to respond to that as a country. If my central forecast for China and India is not right and we end up with a different configuration there, we'll need to respond, and we'll have to do it through those mechanisms I talked about. And again, to repeat, human capital. That's incredibly important, because if I'm right and we have a high exchange rate for a long period of time, the economy needs to go through adjustment and human, and we need to be high value added, and we do that through human capital. But if I'm wrong, and the China and India boom tails out, and the exchange rate has to adjust, and fiscal policy and monetary policy adjust, and the labour market adjust, we're going to be better off if we've got good human capital to do that adjustment with. So they're the broad contours of the things we talk about internally. They're not things the Reserve Bank can do anything about. These are areas of structural policy. But I think it's incredibly important we don't take our eyes off them and just think, well, we've got this wonderful period ahead, and not do the investment, particularly in human capital formation, that we need to do.